Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, Senior Security Analyst at WatchGuard Threat Lab, and today I'm joined by a new guest host. You want to introduce yourself?
Hello everyone, my name is Emil Hazan.
Ah, Emil. And then don't worry, Corey will be back in the trailer section after we get through the news, which today we're talking about two attacks against wireless security, one that speeds up an offline crack and another being a re-release of one of my favorite tools from years past. Also a cryptocurrency heist that's leading to AT&T being sued for $220-something million. And then Corey and I will jump into our favorite bits that we saw at the DEF CON security conference in Las Vegas this year. Stay tuned. All right, let's jump into the news. And today I'm actually joined by a new guest, Mr. Emil Hazan. Say hi.
Hello, everyone.
Hooray. So we have a few different topics to talk about today, two of them revolving around wireless security, and one of them actually revolving around DEF CON, which both of us just got back from. Did you have a good time there?
It was awesome. Definitely recommend it for everyone.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. So our first one is actually the PMKID vulnerability, or Pairwise Master Key ID, if you don't feel like jumping on the acronym train today. So this one was actually just disclosed a few weeks ago, I believe, and it revolves around a new attack targeting WPA2. Now, this isn't the first attack against WPA2, right? We saw a crack back in June, I think, or no, it was late last year, right? Mm-hmm. Where an attacker could force a client into reinstalling a new key, which basically compromised the security of the access point. So this is a new attack, mostly completely unrelated to crack. In this particular attack, it allows the bad guy to ping the access point and get what's called the Pairwise Master Key ID. And the Pairwise Master Key ID is a hash of the Pairwise Master Key, which is the encryption key for wireless. Once you have the encryption key for a session, you can decrypt everything across that session. The PMKID is a hash that contains the encryption key, the Pairwise Master Key, a string that just says PMK name. I don't know why that's in there, but it's in there. The MAC address of the access point and the MAC address of the client. And once the attacker is able to grab this hash, they can then take it offline and attempt to crack it. Seems pretty interesting, right? One of the things I liked about this was it was actually disclosed by Hashcat. Emil's probably very familiar with Hashcat from his recent works with passwords, and that it's a great tool for cracking passwords, basically. And on their forums, one of their administrators actually disclosed this vulnerability and gave instructions and a new tool for carrying it out automatically. One of the big differentiators between this and a traditional attack against WPA2 is that it doesn't require a full four-way handshake. In the past, the attackers had to sit there and sniff a client association with an access point in order to attempt to crack that Pairwise master key offline. With this new attack, they can just ping the access point and say, hey, give me your ID, and then they can attempt to crack that hash. Now, as I'm sure you've noticed, Emil, cracking hashes isn't all that easy, is it?
Definitely is not.
No, you need quite a bit of information. In this case, you would need the client address, the access point address, and then you need some additional info to go into the Pairwise master key. They actually did provide instructions on pre-generating potential Pairwise master keys offline to try and speed up the crack, but it still potentially could take quite a bit of time for this type of attack. So maybe not the most critical thing right now, but still something to watch out for, I think.
How can we protect ourselves?
So in this case, I mean, there's a few different things, I think. You brought up a good point earlier with passwords, right? You want to dive into that?
One good thing to keep in mind is that this affects only the pre-shared key aspects of the WPA. And essentially, if you practice good password requirements, you should be fairly fine.
Yeah, that's a great point. So it affects pre-shared key, which is what we call basically everything that isn't WPA2 enterprise or an open network. It's what you probably use at home, where you enter in a password, you could give out your friends your Wi-Fi password, and then hop on the network. that pairwise master key is derived from that shared secret. And part of cracking the hash and cracking the PMKID involves trying to find that shared secret again. And so if you use a really strong shared secret, it can go a long way to keeping you protected, because it makes it much more difficult for the attacker to crack it, because generally they're not just brute forcing it. They're using some sort of dictionary attack, or going, if they are brute forcing it, they're not going to get past, like, you know, 9-10 characters without the NSA's quantum computer, right? So using a strong password, something like correct horse battery staple, or maybe not that one exactly, since that's probably everyone's Wi-Fi password now if you read XKCID. But any recommendations on that front? You just did a bunch of research on password length, right?
Password length is the key contributor to this. Obviously, still use numbers and symbols and a mix of lower and uppercase characters.
Yeah, so really your goal in this case is just to make it more difficult for the attacker to crack. Using dictionary words is okay, so long as you mix them with different symbols or even more dictionary words. But still, these tools like Hashcat, for example, have rules that come within them for appending words together or changing punctuation or adding letters and numbers that can help speed up attacks if your password follows a certain pattern that most people's passwords do. I'll be honest, my guest password at home probably isn't the most secure and might be easily cracked with this type of attack. But my main password that no one else connects to at home, probably pretty safe for now.
So is it safe to say that for small and medium businesses, the lack of using WPA2 PSK is a good thing?
I mean, it depends. If they're an open network, no, it's a terrible thing, right? But WPA2 Enterprise has a few more benefits on top of just the pre-shared key. It has mutual authentication, so the client validates the access point itself, and the access point validates the client. Also, each user has their own password, basically, because you're typically using corporate credentials to connect, which means if you crack one master key or session key or pairwise master key or whatever you want to call it, you don't get access to everyone else's too. So there are benefits to using WPA2 Enterprise over pre-shared key, right? So our second topic still follows on the wireless train. This one, I mean, Corey's not here to talk about Corey's old times and hacking from many moons past. So now it's my turn to talk about something I remember from quite a few years back. DEF CON 22, which was 2014, I believe. There was a talk that I went to, and this was one of my first DEF CON, so this was all when it was new and shiny and awesome. There's a talk I went to called Manna from the Heaven, given by Dominic White. He goes by Singe as his handle, and Ian Van de Veers. I'm pretty sure I butchered that, but it looks French, so we'll see. Their Manna from the Heavens talk was all around wireless security and this toolkit they released to hack it, basically. The Karma attack had been around for a while. Karma being where an access point will basically respond to any probe sent out from a phone. I guess backing up even further, when connecting to a wireless network, your phone will send out a beacon or a probe and say, hey, are you there? So when I'm walking around in the mall, my phone will say, hey, Mark's home Wi-Fi, are you there? And if Mark's home Wi-Fi responds, you'll see it show up in your phone as a available network. If not, it's not in the area, it won't show up. Karma attacks basically respond to any probe that they see. So as you're walking around at the RSA conference hall by some booths that are doing experiments, you might suddenly see GoGo in-flight Wi-Fi or Starbucks Wi-Fi or Tully's Wi-Fi start showing up because your phone is beaconing out to see if they're there. Now, back in DEF CON 22 at this talk, they released a new toolkit that improved the Karma attacks. It added tools like forcing users to de-auth, so kick them off whatever the network they're on to force them to authenticate again, in which case you can spoof it and say, actually, no, that's me. Connect to me. It had tricks to help get around iOS, so iPhones, and their unwillingness to probe for hidden networks. And it was a pretty cool toolkit at the time. It got a lot of traction. I know our resident wireless guy, Ryan Orsi, it's one of his favorite toolkits probably. But this year at DEF CON 26, Singe, or Dominic White, was back. He had another talk, and this time releasing an update for the Mana Toolkit. He added some more improvements. First of all, it can target more than one access point or client now. That's something Mana previously couldn't do. So that's kind of cool, at least for research purposes, of course. It also added support for something called Snoopy. If you're not familiar with it, Dominic's actually from SensePost, which is a security company, and they had this tool called Snoopy that can help geolocate access point MAC addresses and de-anonymize MAC addresses to map out attackers. Well, this toolkit uses it to map out clients instead and get around some more of the protections they have, like MAC de-anonymization. And it was just, it's cool seeing them continuing to make updates and working on this tool, 4 years after the fact now from when I first saw it. And I guess this just points out that, I mean, wireless security seems to be getting a lot of heat lately. We saw Crack a few months ago. We saw that PMKID vulnerability just a few weeks ago. Mana Toolkit re-release. I mean, it seems like WPA2 has been around for, a decade now, something like that?
It seems that with wireless technology advancements, that mobility is a key factor in technology use.
Yeah, exactly. And WPA2 seems to be showing its age now, though. And WPA3 is right around the corner. I mean, the standard was just released a few months ago. And it does add some protections to help protect against some of these attacks. Like, one of WPA3's biggest selling points is that it adds something called perfect forward secrecy to every single connection. And what this does is it generates a new key for each session, even if you reconnect or between all different clients, even if you're sharing the same password for the wireless network. That way, if an attacker is able to crack one session, they don't suddenly have the keys to the kingdom for every session of anyone that has connected to that single SSID. And that will actually go a long ways towards helping against the PMKID vulnerability, I think, right?
Oh, definitely.
And actually, so the person who found the PMKID vulnerability was looking for issues in WPA3. And they haven't found anything so far, at least not published it. But by looking at the spec and trying to attack the spec, they noticed that the spec for WPA2 had this issue where you could force the access point into sending out this PMKID value. Pretty interesting how the new is kind of helping killing the old. Other protections that might be useful, Wi-Fi passpoints, something that's been around for 5 years now and no one really talks about it. And have you heard of Wi-Fi passport?
Personally, I have not, no.
Yeah, so it's the standard that came out 5 years ago, I think. Still taking off. I mean, WPA2 came out a decade and a half ago, and it still only took till 5-10 years ago to finally take off. So it's still growing, but Wi-Fi Passpoint basically brings WPA2 Enterprise to what would traditionally be open networks. I did air quotes there in case you didn't see it on the podcast. And it brings mutual authentication for when you're going to Starbucks, for example, where you have this one set of credentials for the Wi-Fi Passpoint network. And if you go to a Wi-Fi Passpoint certified location, you can log in with those credentials and then they communicate up to the cloud or whatever with the backend authentication database. And then you can have your own single encrypted session instead of just joining an open network.
That seems like we need to raise awareness for this for public Wi-Fi spots.
It's cool. I mean, it is a Wi-Fi Alliance standard thing, so I'm sure there's certification costs that are slowing it down a bit, but it has great protections in it, and it's something that I hope we will start to see taking off, especially with all the buzz around WPA3 having people look back into Wi-Fi again from a security standpoint. So, I mean, I guess that's it for wireless. Do you have any takeaways you want to toss around?
Yeah, definitely. Make sure you're always mindful of what Wi-Fi connection you connect with and what kind of encryption it offers. And it's important to stay encrypted yourself with using VPN access, especially on those open and insecure Wi-Fi SSIDs.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, people like the convenience of connecting to Starbucks Wi-Fi, right? or GoGo InFlight or whatever open network where you don't have to enter in a password or go ask the barista what the password is, right? And VPNs can help protect you with some of the security issues that come along with that by giving you a encrypted tunnel out to some endpoint that you trust. Instead of all of your computer's traffic being unencrypted, or at least if you're not using the HTTPS, everything else being unencrypted, everything is just shuttled across this tunnel somewhere else, so you don't have to worry about who's sniffing on the network.
And also, if you're not worried about data cellular usage, you can hotspot your phone and have your own private internet access.
That's a good point. Actually, I did that quite a lot at DEF CON and Black Hat this year, of course, with a very strong password for that network as well to help hopefully keep my data safe. HTTPS is probably another good thing to consider. There's been a really big push towards HTTPS lately. In fact, it was last month, or maybe only 3 weeks ago, Google released Chrome version 68, where now every single website that doesn't use HTTPS is labeled as insecure. And I think that's a huge benefit for wireless, because one of the biggest arguments against HTTPS has been like, why does the average blog need it? Like, who cares if Joe's bike blog has encryption or not? But one of the issues is with wireless, because if you go visit Joe's bike blog at a Wi-Fi cafe somewhere, that connection of the website is unencrypted, which means an attacker sitting on the network can inject whatever they want into it. They could inject a cryptocurrency mining JavaScript file into it just because that web connection is not encrypted. And this is, I mean, there's a guy I really like. I can't remember his name. There's a researcher I follow on Twitter who I remember watching this chain over the course of a week, where he started out week one saying, why do we need encryption on all these websites? Some of them, it just doesn't make sense. And then by like day five, he had been completely convinced otherwise. And I thought that was actually fantastic, because it showed a lot of the issues that come about with having unencrypted websites, especially over wireless networks. So I think we got time. There's one more little bonus news story I wanted to throw in around one of my favorite topics. If you're a regular on the show or following my blog posts, you're probably familiar that I'm pretty big on blockchain technology and cryptocurrency. And when I woke up this morning, I saw a news article about a gentleman named Michael Turpin, who is in the process of suing AT&T for $24 million plus $200 million in damages from a cryptocurrency heist. So you might think, what does AT&T have to do with cryptocurrency? In this case, he had access to an account with $24 million in cryptocurrency to his name, and it was protected by his phone. I assume an application on his phone. He didn't dive into details, and I didn't have time to read through the 70-page court filing for it. An attacker who knew about this account managed to convince AT&T to doing something called a SIM swap. So SIM swaps are pretty normal. If I go drop my phone off the boat, I'm going to need a new SIM card in order to continue using my network plan. And so I would go to the AT&T store and go say, hey, I need a new SIM card. I lost mine. In this case, the attacker used social engineering and a bit of info about Mr. Turpin to go in and convince AT&T that he was the owner of this account, and got them to swap over his phone number onto this SIM card. And then once he had access to that number, he was most likely able to resync apps. If you've ever gotten a new phone, you're probably familiar with Google and iOS. You just got a new phone, right? You probably went right through this, syncing all of your apps back to the phone. In this case, including the one that gave him access to his account. And then the attacker managed to guess the 6-digit password that was used to protect that account. And with that, they drained all of the dude's cryptocurrency, and now he's suing AT&T. So I thought this was interesting. What are your thoughts on it?
I feel that I wonder, actually, if they requested a photo ID of the perpetrator.
Yeah, you would think that would be like the first thing you ask if you're at the AT&T store and someone says, I need to swap over my phone account. Like, okay, cool, prove who you are. And I can't remember the last time I did it and if they required a photo ID or not, but it seems like at least the minimal amount of effort you would want to put into protecting that account. I mean, as it turns out, this isn't the first time that Mr. Turpin was hit. back in 2017, so last year, someone did a similar attack against him. They swapped his SIM card out to another account. And in that case, he claims that AT&T put him on a high-risk list or a high-value target list or whatever you want to call it, which should have had additional scrutiny too. At the same time, though, I mean, if you're relying on a 6-digit code to protect your account and then a bad guy not getting a hold of your phone number, that seems like bad news bears, right?
Hopefully he changed the number from the previous attempt.
Yeah. And I mean, from this, I guess my takeaway would be don't rely on, I'm counting this as a single factor because a 6-digit password is not an authentication factor at this point. That can be cracked in the order of like hours on a decent computer, especially if whatever website or app he's connecting to doesn't have any throttling, which these days, not a lot of them do. Also, I feel like this is a good point to pull out my Corey hat again and pimp a WatchGuard product. And in this case, Offpoint, which is our new mobile factor authentication app, actually has protections against this type of attack. We use something called mobile DNA, where it actually takes the information about your phone, the hardware itself. So the chips that are on it, the EMEID, the information of the device itself. So if an attacker is able to SIM swap or even clone your operating system and then attempt to run it in an emulator, it'll fail the checks and they won't be able to get access to that multi-factor authentication code, which is something pretty cool. And I mean, I'm not sure if it would have helped Mr. Turpin in this case. $24 million is still a lot of money and a tough pill to swallow, especially with the virtue of hindsight here, but it's still something that I think would benefit many people, especially if you're protecting high-valued accounts like this.
So it sounds like Offpoint's a good tool to use.
And in this case, for multi-factor authentication, yes. I don't know if it would have protected him in this case with whatever app was used to access his account. Maybe he should have used a stronger password. But at the same time, it still blows my mind that people are this good at social engineering AT&T workers or really any mobile company into swapping over phone numbers and SIM cards without any additional verification.
I guess a good question to ponder upon here is what lengths are you willing to go to protect yourself?
Yeah, and it probably matters on how high of a value target you are. One of my things I always point out is know your threat model. So if you're a guy with $24 million in cryptocurrency in your account, you're going to put a lot more protections into whatever has access to that account than you would if you're my mom who just has pictures of her dog, right? So he probably should have taken more care, use accounts that allow more than a 6-digit PIN code, or maybe don't even access it from your phone at all. Whereas people like my mom, probably doesn't matter. She'll be all right, even if someone ports over her phone. It'll just be a bit of an inconvenience. Actually, that's happened before, now that I think about it. And it was a bit of an inconvenience. So anything else you want to add?
Make sure you guys practice good password security and watch out where you guys connect for Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
Take precautions there out.
Sounds like you just wrote a research paper on password security and you're haunted by what you saw.
Indeed, I am.
I guess that's that then, and we can move on to the next section where I will be bringing back our good friend Corey to talk about the talks we went to at DEF CON this year. In this section, I guess it's time to talk a little bit more about DEF CON now that it's just about over for us.
Yeah, we got about half a day left, man.
Yep, although by the time this airs, I think we'll be quite a bit long gone. Yeah.
We'll be on vacation, sipping margaritas on the beach. We'll
exactly.
need it after this.
Yeah, so figure we'd pick a few of our favorite talks and just go over what we found interesting. DEF CON's definitely more hands-on and more technical than Black Hat.
So yeah, they get very technical.
Some cooler talks, some are a little bit more difficult to follow if you're not specifically familiar
yeah.
with it.
But not an assembly ninja, sometimes you'd be like, what?
Exactly. But how about, what was one of your favorite ones from this week?
So I had a ton, and the listeners can also see some in the video we both did on Secplicity. But I think we keep on talking IoT, but it's definitely a big theme everywhere at DEF CON and at Black Hat. I went to one that was called Who Controls the Controllers? Hacking Crestron IoT Automation Systems. And it was by a guy named Ricky Lawshaw. I hope I pronounced that right. I can pronounce his actual alias. By the way, at DEF CON, it's actually weird that people actually give their name now. When I started, it was alias only. It was kind of an anonymous conference.
They've actually noted that, and that they are seeing more people submitting under real names instead of aliases, and they would encourage you to do otherwise.
Exactly. And by the way, that's what the whole Loft people did for a long time until they went to, they were the Loft, by the way, old Hacking Crew. If you watch our video, you hear about them. Those guys, even when they went to Congress, they had their aliases on the little placard. So they were awesome. Anyways, Ricky Lawshaw is known as Headless Zeek. And basically, if you haven't heard of Crestron, basically, this is a company that makes, I would say, restaurant tablet systems. They can often be found in kitchens to do orders. They might be found in hotels, by the way, where you might do tablet room service or tablet stuff. They're kind of purpose-built tablets, often using Android or Windows CE tablets that you can find everywhere. And he basically found all kinds of vulnerabilities in them. You know, he basically reverse engineered them. He did the classic starting with firmware. He did both the Windows CE side and the Android side. As always, you know, all the vulnerabilities or issues we're used to seeing were pretty common. Things like firmware that was unencrypted and not signed. He paid attention. He kind of captured or wire captured some of their communications, found out that they used UDP 41794 and 41795 to do various things, broadcasts for a magic discovery packet to call home, or in some cases send things like video back over the CTP console. He heard some of these systems, by the way, had mechanisms like authentication, but they were turned off by default.
Oh, so secure.
Yeah, very, very well done, guys. So you actually had to know what you were doing to turn the security on. He was able to gain enough access to actually view and modify the SSL certs. So any certificate security that was needed for them to maybe call home and stuff was, I mean, you could grab the cert, no big deal there. Without going in all the super detail, I mean, he did also find a super secret super user backdoor that had a hard-coded password. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, lovely. But what's scary is, you know, once he had that, he could get full remote access to this. And they often had embedded audio mics and cameras, so he could just turn that on. They also supported the RTSP protocol, so you could stream that video. So just next time you guys are at a hotel and there's a cool tablet there where you can check out the hotel and order room service, if it has a webcam, you might think about someone kind of wirelessly RTSPing that webcam in your hotel room back to wherever they are in the world. So that was very interesting, kind of 101 things not to do with IoT, which seems to be kind of the norm when you look at a lot of these cheaper or specific IoT devices. One takeaway, though, which I thought was funny, is he said the WinCE system was actually more secure than the Android one.
Really?
Yeah, and I don't know why it is. Maybe it's because WinCE had a few security mechanisms that you couldn't turn off, but he said that one was actually a little harder for him to pwn than the Android one, which, you know, is not what I would automatically have assumed.
No, not neither I as well.
Yeah, so that was interesting.
I went to a few different talks. One of them I went to, I think you were at as well. I mean, it wasn't really wholly applicable to us, but it was still interesting listening to people talk about putting thermite charges in their hard drives. This one was all about trying to protect your data from unauthorized tampering, basically, and how to booby trap your server so that someone can't go in there with a shim or a drill.
So this might be if you have a server, and I don't know why you'd need to do this if you're purely legal, but maybe you run a VPN service and you don't want your privacy super important if you're doing that. And if you're running a VPN service, you do need servers and public colos. So this is kind of how to protect those in case unknown entity, maybe the authorities ever raided that colo, right?
Yeah, and their hook on it was that some companies like Apple have reported that they suspect that their servers might be intercepted in transit and someone might be modifying them.
It's a common story from Cisco that there's pictures of alleged pictures of NSA people unboxing Cisco routers as they go to foreign countries and implanting backdoors into those. So
in this, they went out and bought some Dell servers. They installed a bunch of switches to detect when like the case is open or if someone tries to shim in and open the case or stick a probe in. They had motion sensors, tilt sensors, light sensors, all sorts of sensors that when tripped, it would either turn off the system if it was using full encryption. It is now effectively locked unless they can crack the encryption, which they actually suspect. They mentioned some article.
But
that,
what was it? Do you know the name of the, was it Opus, Samsung, a certain hard drive?
Opus.
And I think it's Opus. There's certain hard drives that it is a black box system, which is, if you're trying to protect your system, who knows if some authority has a backdoor into the black box. But apparently Opus is something that will encrypt your hard drives. But if you power down it, or when you're powered up, your hard drives are decrypted. Yep. But Opus can decrypt or encrypt
deletes
them,
its key.
Yeah, in seconds.
Yeah,
or probably milliseconds maybe. It sounded like very fast.
Exactly. So, but again, they pointed out that things like the NSA might have a quantum computer within the next few years that's capable of cracking some of these decryptions.
Yeah.
And so they went on to talk about how they have thermite charges. And
that
some
was
of
crazy.
Their, yeah. He mentioned they had to drive here instead of flying because of
I'm not
these thermite
sure if
charges.
The TSA would like thermite in a hard drive.
I mean,
I was fascinated by it. I thought you'd just put thermite on top of the hard drive. But the way it explained it to me, when they were installing it, they needed to, he had to give some beers to some college to use their clean room. Because
right.
It sounds like he opened up the hard drive to the platters. And again, the density of those platters nowadays, a tiny, tiny speck of dust is going to wipe out a ton of sectors. And he also, I mean, these were real hardware hacking nerds in that they're talking about how you can make a little, well, if you can't go to the college and get a clean room, you can make like a humidity box.
Right.
And the humidity kind of sucks the dust to the bottom. And then theoretically, you could still open the hard drive platter, but you probably still will, if you're not in a clean room, you're probably going to ruin some sectors.
Yeah.
But anyways, I didn't realize they had put the thermite inside with the platters. Because I believe it would still burn right through the drive itself.
He even like talked about the thermite compounds he was using to find the one that would ignite the quickest and burn through as fast as possible.
I think they use model rocketry as igniters because they're good at effective at igniting the thermite.
Yeah. So again, not wholly applicable, but still
I'm not
really
running anywhere servers. I'm not the Pirate Bay that needs to get my servers to die as soon as the Norwegian authorities come.
Neither am I.
Yeah, I've never done that. That was kind of interesting, though.
Yeah.
It was a fun talk.
Another talk I went to was called Taking a Bite Out of Enterprise Blockchain. If you've followed our podcast
you
or my research for a while, you
Mark.
Know that, yeah, I'm pretty big on cryptocurrency and blockchain technology as a whole. This one was by, I'm going to butcher their name, Parsea Hakimian and Stark Redstell. And it was, they actually attacked what was... it's Hyperledger is the company, and they have a blockchain called Fabric, where it's not a public blockchain. It's a closed private blockchain, you might call it. I think their official term was a permissioned blockchain.
Wow.
They found that if you could, you have different, potentially different companies would have nodes on this blockchain, like a bike store and an insurance company and a repair shop. And each of them have a node on the blockchain, and they validate purchases. They validate insurance requests for repairing. And through their research, they found if you were able to compromise one of these nodes, like the repair shop, you could theoretically submit falsified repair requests and just earn yourself free money out of the pockets of the insurance company, for example.
Oh, wow.
It was interesting. They pointed out that none of their attacks really targeted the blockchain itself. Most of these blockchain tools still need a front-end application to interface with them, whether it be a website or an API or an app or something along those lines.
And I suppose it was those.
And they were able to hack those interfaces in order to affect the blockchain.
Huh.
So hack a website to make it so an insurance button is always clicked so that when the contract is created for this bike purchase, it would have insurance enabled so that then they could submit their fraudulent claim even if the victim never purchased insurance.
That's interesting.
So it was interesting. It was a unique take. I hadn't really... I've always been thinking about blockchain security, not necessarily the apps that interface with it. And it was just a fun little one to go to.
It makes me think of all the things like if you hack an Android device, even if it needs a user dialogue to be clicked on, you know, if I can open a browser and I can control the keyboard and mouse, there's ways I can actually click on a box invisibly before you even see it. And so if you control the app that controls the bank transaction, the blockchain, whatever, game over, really.
Yeah, so it was interesting, and it was cool seeing how just one compromised, I guess partner would be the right term for it, could affect the entire system and steal money from everyone else in it. So how about you? Any cool talks you went to?
Yeah, I've done a ton. Another one. A couple. Deja vu, by the way, Mark. Yes, I have gone to cool talks. Another big talk I really enjoyed today was actually police body cam hacks. That's what I put down for the title, so I hope that's it. But it was given by a guy named Josh Mitchell. And by the way, right at the beginning, there was drama. Apparently, he had 7 different police body cams he's going to talk about, but he could only talk about 5 for reasons. So apparently, there's 2 companies that he's probably waiting for. But anyways, some of them were like cheaper ones that you can get on Amazon. Some of them were big, kind of more professional ones that I think a lot of cops, including cops in New York, run. And I won't go through every single manufacturer name, but it was just kind of a big bevy list of all the IoT vulnerabilities, like the worst things you can imagine. A lot of these police body cams and the software, they act as wireless APs. So if you want to stream from them real time, you connect to them as an AP. Dumb things like one's SSID was FireCam, and of course that was its default password too.
Another one. Why is that such a common trend?
I don't get it. Why don't make your password the SSID? That's kind of dumb. The default admin and user password. The admin was like 6 8s. The user was 6 0s. What was worse, by the way, was you couldn't have longer than 6 character passwords. So even if you change those passwords, you're limited to 6 characters. Again, firmware not being signed in encrypting was an industry standard. There's one where he kind of went, he found the code where you could set a new password, and it didn't require you to verify the current one to set a new password. So that was totally lovely. Root Telnet with no password. He found that once. He found one where he actually found, again, this was actually a CLI, but it, basically the password was the same as the username. But what was worse is you could put anything for password in username and it would affect it. Instead of any encryption on things that had sensitive data like config files, they were just Zord, which, you know, anyone can reverse. And I could just go on and on and on. He did this repeatedly for many, many of these particular cameras. All of them allowed FTP. All of them had RTSP, again, for streaming video from them. But what he was really pushing on this is, the other thing is like, the videos are supposed to be digitally signed because this is evidence, right? You could be putting someone in jail using this digitally signed, you know, validated file for evidence to put people in jail. And he found that one, you know, not only weren't the files, he could make a file that was digitally signed that was full of A's. So really, if anyone's using this for actual evidence, is pretty scary. Plus, I mean, from the criminal side of things, if someone has these body cams and you want to delete or get access to the videos, it seems pretty trivial to do. So that was very, very interesting. You know, police body cams are obviously becoming a thing, mm-hmm. unfortunately, because in some cases, you know, they might seem to do things that they shouldn't. They're not very secure. I'm not sure if we can trust them yet.
I mean, it just seems like another continuation of the IoT conundrum where these devices are put out quickly as possible for as cheaply as possible.
Absolutely.
And security kind of falls by the wayside. So hopefully, I mean, especially in something used by law enforcement, I hope they really get their act together and these manufacturers
law enforcement, just because this stuff becomes evidence, that digital signature, that forensic chain of evidence is really important.
Yeah.
So they can't, it's not jokingly running a camera in a hotel, which by the way is kind of gross too, but this can really cause people some big trouble
Did any of the manufacturers get back to him at all with anything? Or
I think some of these, I think the 5 he talked about, he's done disclosure, but he didn't say anything about patches.
Man, well, hooray.
Go interwebs.
That's the one thing with DEF CON is you always come out of some of these talks just, how did that happen?
And job security, Mark.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm not concerned at all. There will always be something to hack, especially when we hit that 20 billion connected IoT devices here in a few years.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So I guess that was pretty cool. And it's time to wrap it up. So we'll see you around next week. Thanks again for listening.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
All right, everyone, that was our episode for the day. Thank you for listening. As always, you can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_ and Corey @SecAdept. Please feel free to tweet at us or send us a message if you have any questions or anything you'd like to see brought up on a future episode. You can also check out secplicity.org for your daily security news and insights. Thanks again for listening. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. See you next time.